Hi, I'm Richard Karn, and you may have seen me on TV talking about the world's number one expandable garden hose. Well, the brand new Pocket Hose Copperhead with Pocket Pivot is here, and it's a total game changer. Old-fashioned hoses get kinks and creases at the spigot, but the Copperhead's Pocket Pivot swivels 360 degrees for full water flow and freedom to water with ease all around your home. When you're all done, this rust-proof anti-burst hose shrinks back down to pocket size for effortless handling and tidy storage. Plus, your super light and ultra-durable pocket hose Copperhead is backed with a 10-year warranty. What could be better than that? I'll tell you what, an exciting exclusive offer just for you. For a limited time, you can get a free pocket pivot and their 10-pattern sprayer with the purchase of any size Copperhead hose. Just text WATER to 64000. That's WATER to 64000 for your two free gifts with purchase. W-A-T-E-R to 64000.
By texting 64000, you agree to receive recurring automated marketing messages from Pocket Hose. Message and data rates may apply. No purchase required. Terms apply. Available at pockethose.com/terms.
Hello, and welcome back to Into the Killing. In our past episodes, we focus on genetic fingerprinting. That's the technique that compares DNA at a crime scene to the DNA of possible suspects. In today's episode, we'll talk about the earliest known instance of fingerprinting being used in a murder case. Fingerprinting has to do with the ridges of people's fingers that are unique to each person. Then we'll discuss a bizarre cold case that was solved because of fingerprinting. The earliest known use of fingerprinting in criminal cases dates back to the Qin Dynasty, which was 221 to 206 BC. There are records that fingerprints were used in the investigation of burglaries. Significant steps in the science of fingerprinting wouldn't happen for nearly 1800 years. In 1686, using a newly invented instrument, the microscope, an Italian physiologist named Marcello Malpighi discovered that our hand surfaces have ridges in them. 137 years later, in 1823, famed physiologist Jan Purkinje discovered 9 categories of fingerprints. Decades later, in the 1880s, Sir Francis Galton moved the science of fingerprinting forward immensely. Galton was the cousin of Charles Darwin. Galton was examining fingerprints to see if they indicated anything about heredity. He was never able to connect fingerprints with heredity. What he did discover was that everyone's fingerprints were unique and they didn't change throughout someone's life. He also discovered that there are 3 most common types of fingerprints: loop, whorl, and arch. Sometime later, it was discovered that fingerprints develop in the womb at about 6 months. Also, if you somehow lose your fingerprints, they will grow back in the same pattern. The only way to permanently alter your fingerprints is to scar your fingers. Galton's discoveries regarding fingerprinting would be put into practice for the first time by a man named Juan Busetich. Busetich was born in Croatia in 1858 and he immigrated to Argentina in 1884. In Argentina, he got a job with the Central Police Department. In 1891, he was appointed to the head of the Office of Identification. After getting his new job, Busetich read about Galton's research regarding fingerprinting in a scientific journal. Based on Galton's finding, Busetich started the first fingerprinting filing system in the world. Fingerprinting was first used in a murder investigation in June 1892. Different sources list different dates when the crime was committed. Many sources say it happened on June 29, 1892, while others say it happened on June 19, 1892. What is known is that the crime was committed in a village called Necochea. Necochea is on the coast of Argentina, south of the capital, Buenos Aires. There are also several accounts of what exactly happened. This account of the crime comes from the book The Devil's Gentleman, Privilege, Poison, and the Trial That Ushered in the 20th Century. A woman, 26-year-old Francisca Rojas, had come home and found the door to her home open. Francisca said that her neighbor, Ramon Velasquez, emerged from her home and then ran away. In the bedroom, she found the bodies of her two children, who were 6 and 4 years old. Their heads had been beaten in. In other versions of the story, Francisca had her neck cut, but the cut wasn't deep. Francisca said that Velasquez had asked her to marry him several times, but she had rejected him every time. The last time he proposed to her was earlier that day. She had said no because she was in love with someone else. She said that Velasquez became angry and threatened to hurt her children. Velasquez was questioned, and he denied killing the children. So the police physically tortured him. He was also bound and left with the bodies of the dead children for several hours. Velasquez did admit to making the threat, but he maintained that he did not kill the children. Also, he had an alibi for the time of the murders. He was out with friends. We're going to take a quick break from our episode to talk about our sponsor, BetterHelp. Let's face it, 2020 was hard on many of us, and the holidays tend to be tough already. Now is the perfect time to get help with your mental health with BetterHelp. I know I've had my own problems, and it's been nice to talk to a professional counselor. I feel more at peace and in control of my work and personal life. When you sign up for BetterHelp, they often connect you with a licensed counselor within 48 hours. BetterHelp is not a crisis line, it's not self-help, it's professional counseling done securely online. It's available worldwide, and they offer a wide range of services. You may be able to find a specialist that isn't available in your local area. It's also much more affordable compared to traditional therapy. BetterHelp, which is better, H-E-L-P, like the Beatles song, has a special offer for Into the Killing listeners. Just go to betterhelp.com/listed, you'll get 10% off your first month. Visit betterhelp.com/listed, that's better, H-E-L-P, and join the over 1 million people who have taken charge of their mental health with the help of experienced professionals. An inspector from the capital, Eduardo Alvarez, was sent to the town. Alvarez questioned Francisca Rojas, and she said that she did not touch her children's bodies when she got home. Alvarez looked around the crime scene, and on the bedroom door, he noticed a brown stain. Alvarez had some training from Juan Bucetich, and he knew that the stain was a bloody fingerprint. He then cut out the part of the door that contained the fingerprint. Bucetich had taught him what he knew about fingerprinting and what to look for when comparing a suspect's fingerprint to the bloody fingerprint. Alvarez had Francisca fingerprinted. Then, using the magnifying glass, he compared her fingerprints to the bloody fingerprint found on the door. It was clear to him that the bloody fingerprint belonged to Francisca. She was confronted with the evidence. If she didn't touch her children, then how did her bloody fingerprint end up on the door? She broke down and confessed to the murders. She explained that she wanted to marry a man, but he did not want to marry her because she had children. Francisca decided to kill them to frame Velasquez. She beat her children with a rock, and after the murders, she dropped the rock down a well. She cleaned herself up, but she missed cleaning off the bloody fingerprint. According to Clarín, Argentina's biggest newspaper, Francisca was sentenced to an indefinite amount of time in a penitentiary. From that first case, the science of fingerprinting spread. In the summer of 1924, the FBI created the Identification Division. They started the first American national database of fingerprints. Over the next 50 years, they collected over 200 million fingerprint cards. In the 1990s, the FBI started to develop a computer system to store the data. The Integrated Automatic Fingerprint Identification System launched on July 28, 1999. It's better known by the acronym IAFIS. We did our research, and we could not find the first cold case that was solved thanks to IAFIS. Instead, we'll discuss a case that was incredibly cold that was solved with the help of IAFIS. In the early morning hours of July 22, 1957, in El Segundo, California, police officers 29-year-old Richard Phillips and 25-year-old Milton Curtis were on duty. Both men were married and had young children. Around 1:30 a.m., a call came over the radio. It was Curtis, and he was requesting help. Two other officers had driven past them just minutes earlier. They rushed back to where they last saw Phillips and Curtis. When they got there, Phillips was lying in the street with three bullet wounds in his back. Curtis was in the police car. He also had three bullet wounds. They were in one of his arms and his chest. Neither man survived their injuries. Before Phillips died, he had fired six shots. About four blocks from the crime scene, a car was found abandoned and there were three bullet holes in the back. It was clear that was the car that Phillips and Curtis had pulled over when they were shot. Inside the car, the police found evidence that the killer may have been shot himself. They also found two partial thumbprints on the steering wheel. Both were from the killer's left thumb. Investigators learned that the two officers pulled the man over after he ran a red light. The officers had started writing a ticket when the man killed them. Investigators wondered why someone would shoot two police officers to death over a minor traffic violation. Then they learned that the car had been stolen about half an hour before the shooting. A man who was described as being in his 20s with a pompadour haircut and a southern accent surprised two teenage couples in a car that was parked in a lover's lane. The man had a gun and he forced the four teenagers out of the car. He also had a flashlight and some surgical tape. He put tape over their eyes and forced them to strip. When they were naked, he bound them with the surgical tape. He also raped one of the girls, who was just 15. After about an hour, he ordered the four teenagers to walk out into a field. He told them he planned to kill them. As the teenagers stood in the field, they heard the car door close, and then they watched the man drive off in their car. They managed to make their way into town, where they found help. A massive manhunt and investigation were launched. One man was arrested, but he was released shortly afterward. Despite the police's best effort to find out who killed their brothers in blue, it wasn't long before the case went cold. 3 years later, in 1960, the police got their first break in the case. A man who lived about a mile from the shooting in Manhattan Beach, California, was doing some yard work. He found a revolver among some weeds. He handed the gun over to the police, and they determined it was the murder weapon. The police discovered that the gun was purchased from a Sears over 1,600 miles away in Shreveport, Louisiana. There was a record of the purchase that included the purchaser's name, which was G.D. Wilson. The police canvassed the area near the store. They found out that a man using the name George D. Wilson had stayed at a YMCA near the store. To stay at the YMCA, he had to fill out a registry form. The police got the form and kept it as evidence. The police then talked to every George D. Wilson in the country and got their fingerprints. Every single one of them was cleared as a suspect. It was clear to the police that George C. Wilson was an alias. The police felt like they were back at square one. The case went cold again. Investigators continued to work on the case until the 1990s. As the millennium was coming to an end, according to one investigator, the case was colder than cold. Then, in September 2002, an unexpected phone call set the wheels in motion that would finally lead to the case being solved. The call came into the El Segundo Police Department. It was a woman who said that her uncle had been bragging about murdering two police officers in their city. The only case that matched the woman's description of the crime were the murders of Richard Phillips and Milton Curtis. So investigators got the evidence out of storage. They sent the two thumbprints to the Los Angeles Sheriff's Department Crime Lab. The crime lab was able to clean up the 44-year-old prints. Then the investigators got a hold of the caller's uncle's fingerprints. It was quickly determined that was not a match. The police thought that they had reached yet another dead end. But it turned out that a tragedy that happened a year earlier had changed their luck. That tragedy was the 9/11 attacks. In the wake of the attacks, the FBI began to beef up the integrated automated fingerprint identification system. This involved collecting all fingerprint records from all 50 states. The investigators decided to run the thumbprints through IAFIS. Amazingly, they got a hit. It was a thumbprint of a man named Gerald Fitt Mason. Mason had been arrested and served time in 1956 for burglary in South Carolina. The police got a hold of a photo of Mason from that time, and he resembled the sketch of the killer. The investigators thought that someone who raped a 15-year-old girl and murdered two police officers had probably led a life of crime. But after that night, Mason stayed a law-abiding citizen. He never even got a ticket for a traffic violation. In 1960, Mason got married, and his wife gave birth to two daughters. His daughters eventually had children of their own. Mason owned 7 service stations, and he became wealthy. He retired in the 1990s. When Mason's thumbprints were matched to the thumbprints left in the car, he was living in his hometown, Columbia, South Carolina, with his wife of 42 years. But the police didn't think that the thumbprint was enough to arrest him. They managed to get a hold of some documents that had Mason's handwriting on them. The handwriting was compared to the handwriting on the registry form from the YMCA that was filled out by George C. Wilson, who purchased the murder weapon. A forensic document examiner said that he was 99.9% sure that was Mason's handwriting on the registry form. In January 2003, police officers descended on the 69-year-old's home. Gerald Mason was arrested without incident. Investigators said that he seemed annoyed to be arrested because the crimes happened so long ago. It had been 46 years and 6 months since the crimes were committed. After Mason was arrested, his body was examined. On his back was a scar from a bullet that grazed his body when Officer Phillips shot at him as he lay dying. Once in custody, Mason confessed to the crimes. He said he felt like he needed to kill the officers because he thought he'd go to death row for raping the 15-year-old girl. In March 2003, Gerald Mason pleaded guilty to the murders of 29-year-old Richard Phillips and 25-year-old Milton Curtis. The 69-year-old grandfather was sentenced to two consecutive life sentences. Mason applied for parole in 2009 after serving about 6 years. His parole was denied. The parole board said he was not allowed to apply for parole for another 15 years. That would have been in 2024 when he was 90 years old. But Gerald Mason died 9 days shy of his 83rd birthday on January 22, 2017. He has served nearly 14 years in prison. The murders of Richard Phillips and Milton Curtis is considered one of the oldest cold cases to be solved in American history. That's all for today. Thank you so much for listening. Our producer and sound designer is Danelle Cloutier. If you just discovered this podcast, please check out our channel, Criminally Listed, on YouTube. We have over 250 videos about crazy true crime cases. If you enjoyed this podcast, please subscribe or follow. We release a new episode every Wednesday. Well, that's all for today. Thanks again for listening.
Hi, I'm Richard Karn, and you may have seen me on TV talking about the world's number one expandable garden hose. Well, the brand new Pocket Hose Copperhead with Pocket Pivot is here, and it's a total game changer. Old-fashioned hoses get kinks and creases at the spigot, but the Copperhead's Pocket Pivot swivels 360 degrees for full water flow and freedom to water with ease all around your home. When you're all done, this rust-proof anti-burst hose shrinks back down to pocket size for effortless handling and tidy storage. Plus, your super light and ultra-durable pocket hose Copperhead is backed with a 10-year warranty. What could be better than that? I'll tell you what, an exciting exclusive offer just for you. For a limited time, you can get a free pocket pivot and their 10-pattern sprayer with the purchase of any size Copperhead hose. Just text WATER to 64000. That's WATER to 64000 for your two free gifts with purchase. W-A-T-E-R to 64000.
By texting 64000, you agree to receive recurring automated marketing messages from Pocket Hose. Message and data rates may apply. No purchase required. Terms apply. Available at pockethose.com/terms.